This is Labor Press. And now back to your hosts, Neil Tappel and Bill Holfeld.
I'm just a working man, but I stay busy every day.
And we're back with more good talk right here on Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. I'm your host, Bill Holfeld, and in the studio with me is my co-host and producer, Joe Maniscalco. Well, Joe, that was some hard-hitting stuff that we got from Doug. And you know, you used the word about him when we were off mic, right? You used the word eloquent, and I couldn't agree with you more. When he expresses, you know, his sentiments, he does it eloquently.
He's the best. He's the best. There's no doubt about it. And, Bill, you know, this past show we've been talking about the importance of working people telling their stories.
Yes.
Right? Or trying to do that and trying to have people who are aligned with them and getting those stories out there. But there are a lot of different stories that are being told in a lot of different ways. And our next guests are telling union-oriented stories, labor-oriented stories in a different way. We have with us Tim Sheard from Hardball Press and Mark Torres, who's a trade unionist, and he's also a children's story writer.
Welcome, fellas. It's nice to have you on the program.
Well, great. Thanks for having us.
Okay. So Mark, I'm going to go to you first. Tell us a little bit about your book. I mean, I actually reviewed your first book for Labor Press, and it was anything but a children's book. It was pretty nitty-gritty murder story. But now I understand you've gone off in a different direction. Tell us about that.
I definitely did. It's more in line with what I do, and Tim Sheard actually pitched the project to me first. We collaborated, and I was excited to work with Tim. And also, it came quite simple because it's pretty much what I do for a living. I'm an attorney. I'm a general counsel of a Teamsters Local 810 in the New York City area. I represent about 4,000 members. And, you know, the idea of the premise of the book is that it's a sanitation employee who collects broken toys and fixes them up and brings them to the local children's shelter. And if, unfortunately, an angry motorist turns him in because it's a rule violation, he gets fired from his job. So he files a grievance with the union, his local union, and they go to an arbitration. And the idea is to try to get him his job back.
Oh, that's a great story. And tell us again, now, what's the title of the book?
The title is Good Guy Jake, published by Hardball Press. It's a children's book. It's bilingual, beautifully illustrated, and it's a great message. I actually, just last week, I read the book to my daughter's class in school, and at the end, there was questions and answers, and they're fifth graders, but they were in tune with the book, and I asked, does anyone here think if would Jake have any success or a chance at getting his job back if he was not a union member? And all of them said no. So they
Wow.
really gave him a message, just a positive union message.
That really, I mean, that's good news, but it really surprises me to know that children of that age are really that much in tune with how powerful being a member of a union is.
Absolutely. And you know, of course, I prefaced it with what I do for a living and making them understand how teachers right there in the classroom, as well as firemen and policemen, that they all have jobs and they all need protection at their jobs. And that's what unions do.
Tim, we'll talk a little bit more about the genesis of this project.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, it's funny that 20 years ago, maybe, I read a story about a sanitation worker who had been fired for taking toys from the trash. He was repairing and painting the toys and giving them to children at a local shelter for Christmas. And for some reason, the story stuck with me. And so when I was talking with Mark, and I know he's an awfully good writer, and I know that he represents sanitation workers, I said, let's do a children's story about this worker that was fired. And it turned out to be a lovely Christmas story because the arbitration hearing occurs a week before Christmas, and the judge reinstates the worker. So it's a lovely, sweet story, and it's uplifting with the Christmas spirit.
And so obviously, with Christmas not being all that far away, this is timely. So before I forget, let's tell everybody where they can get a hold of this book if they want it.
Oh, thank you. They can get it directly from my website, hardballpress.com. They can get it from Amazon, they can get it from Barnes & Noble, or they can go into their local independent bookseller and they can ask them to order it, and the bookseller will be happy to get it for them.
That's great. And I'm going to give you a chance to give all those call letters again later before we leave, make sure people had a chance to get a pen. But before we do, let me ask a technical question of Mark. I mean, you're used to writing legal briefs, you're used to writing in a certain language. As I pointed out before, your first book was certainly anything but a children's book. It was a pretty intense novel about a murder out in Long Island, which I enjoyed very much, by the way. But tell me, did you have difficulty adjusting your language and your writing style?
Absolutely. It took a lot of collaboration with, strangely enough, my children. I realized it's one thing to kind of write, you know, break away from legal writing, and that's where my debut novel was really just kind of freedom to write fiction. But even more so for here, it was important to felt a strong sense of responsibility because we're reaching out to children here. And we didn't want to preach the message that it's okay to break a rule, and we certainly don't do that. But there are circumstances, and much like what we see in my profession through arbitrations, that sometimes someone does break a rule. However, you know, they should get a second chance for various reasons. So it was a little bit trying at the outset to get that message and also break down in simple terms. You know, from arbitrator, we try to simplify to a judge, from an arbitration to a courtroom, to a grievance to a complaint. You know, just some simpler terms that children can grasp easily as we go along in the story.
And what it also does is it kind of introduces children to the fact that there is a legal system in this country and that we have legal rights. And as you were talking, what it reminded me of is just about when I was in the fifth grade, I remember reading Profiles in Courage. And how I was introduced to this whole idea that we have this legal system that's supposed to work for people.
Absolutely, and it's not as glamorous as the grand trial courts you'll see on TV and things that are you know shown often too often, but it is more of the real world and for more of the real world people, the working class and middle class of America.
Bill, you know, just I'm thinking now, it's funny how most of the anti big government people, you know, the self help people, those are the same people that demonize workers, right? And workers are the most altruistic people going. And you see it in Mark's story here. You see it in the other stories that Tim publishes. You see it in Puerto Rico, the Teamsters down there, at the great work that they're doing, and the NYSA nurses to save people. I mean, there's a spirit of volunteerism that is embodied in, you know, in this charming storybook. Is so pervasive.
And you make an excellent point, Joe. And, you know, it's when you were telling the story, guys, and, you know, about the whole genesis of this book and how it came together, it took me back to when I was a little boy. I lived down the block from a firehouse. Again, good civil service union workers, right? And the firehouse used to collect toys for tots way before that phrase was popular. And that's right. What you reminded me of when you told that story. So, again, do we have plans for a follow-up story here, guys?
I will say, and Tim, I'll jump in here because I certainly enjoyed working with Tim, and I'm naturally drawn to his books, and if you look at his website, you see a lot of the working class stories that fit right in my wheelhouse and things I love to read and also write about. So certainly, I definitely see more works in the future, not only children's books, perhaps even collaborating on adult fiction, as Tim has done as well.
Okay, and Tim, tell us. Now, tell us a little bit about how you originally got into publishing, and I know it's not all you do. You know, give us a little background on that.
Well, thanks, Bill. I'm an old retired nurse, 43 years hospital duty, and when I got into my 40s, I started writing stories about my favorite patients and my favorite coworkers, and out of those, I fashioned a bunch of crime novels, mystery novels, set in a fictional hospital with a shop steward detective. So the shop steward is the hero of the story. And the books that I published all went out of print. Either the company went out of business or the hardcover print run ran out and they didn't bring it out in paperback. So I had four novels that were out of print, and they broke my heart. So it was the early days of print on demand, and I learned how to bring them back on my own. So I was pitching my own books, and then as I ran into other writers who were having trouble placing their working class stories, they asked me if I'd help them out and publish the book for them. And so I did one as a favor, and then I did another and another, and then eventually I decided, listen, I need to take this seriously. I need to make this a business so that it survives. So now I've got about 30 authors in my catalog, and I get manuscripts every week. People send me work, so I definitely have more than enough work to hold me for the next couple of years.
So you really got jump started by an act of altruism of your own.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, this this postal worker, he was his arch enemy was this evil manager at this huge facility where they had the postal workers shooting and, you know, so-called going postal. And he realized that if the boss was ever killed, he was the first guy they were going to come and arrest.
Tim, I think we're going to have to leave it there. I hope you come back. We've been speaking to Mark Torres and Tim Scheer. And right now, we're going to flip it over back to Bill Hohlfeld for a spotlight on American labor history.
Thanks, Joe. And it's going to be interesting when you hear one of the quotes in here, because it has very much to do with what we were talking about today. Well, slightly before 11 a.m. on November 11, 1887, hundreds of people gathered in and around a Chicago courthouse to witness the hanging of August Spies, Adolf Fischer, Friedrich Engel, and Albert Parsons. These men had been sentenced to be hung by the neck until dead. For a bomb had exploded at a rally in Haymarket Square at which some of them had been speaking the previous May. The melee came about as a result of the blast caused the death of seven policemen as well as an unspecified number of labor sympathizers. It should be noted that most of the police who died did so by gunshot wounds inflicted by brother officers. It is also noteworthy that the reason the number of injured workers is unclear is because they remained in the shadows after the event for fear of police reprisal. The fact that each of the men accused, all labor organizers, were not guilty had very little to do with the sentence pronounced on them. With no real physical evidence to link them to the bombing, Engel, Fischer, Parsons, and Spies were hung, not for what they did, but for what they thought and what they believed. Parsons had arrived at the rally shortly before it ended with his wife and children in tow, so he was not a likely candidate for violence. Engel was at home playing cards with friends. The testimony of witnesses to that fact was conveniently ignored. The man who provided Spies with an alibi was threatened and run out of town by local businessmen. The evidence presented against Fischer at the trial consisted mainly of his role in printing the Haymarket circulars. The press had hung these men long before the jury was in, with statements like the following from the Chicago Times. "Let us whip these Slavic wolves back to the European dens from which they issue, or in some way exterminate them." Evidence of their guilt had become secondary to the need of corporate America to eradicate any way of thinking other than their own. Yet more memorable still are the last words of Albert Parsons to his wife Lucy when he said, "Our doom to death is the handwriting on the wall, foretelling the downfall of hate, malice, hypocrisy, judicial murder, oppression, and the domination of man over his fellow man. Now ask yourself, are those the words of a murderer?"
Thanks, Bill. That does it for another episode of Labor Press's Blue Collar Buzz. If you like us, follow us on Twitter at LaborPressNY or write to us at bcb@laborpress.org or find us on Facebook. And don't forget to tune in next week at Sunday night at 9 p.m. right here for more Blue Collar Buzz on AM 970 The Answer.